Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
Stay tuned after the news for Philosophy Talk,
a program that questions everything
except your intelligence. So, are we getting married this week, Ken?
Oh, nice of you to ask, but not exactly. This week, we're looking at the state and the regulation of marriage.
Isn't marriage a private matter between two people or between them and their God or maybe their in-laws? What business is it of the state's who I marry?
Well, you might think the state has no business, but the state certainly thinks it does. The state says you can't marry people of different races, you can't marry people of the same sex, and you can't marry more than one person at a time.
Stay tuned as we discuss the philosophical aspects of the state's authority to regulate marriage. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
Our program comes to you from the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco. But think of us as sitting in a circle under the shade of a big old tree, down by the philosophy department at Stanford at Philosophy Corner.
Talking philosophy, sipping some divine nectar. That sounds really cool, John. They pay us to have so much fun?
No, not much. It is nice work if you can get it. Later in the program, we'll be taking listener calls. But first, we need to set the stage a bit. What's our topic?
We're going to talk about marriage and the state. In most countries around the world, you know, there are a lot of rules and regulations about who you can and can't marry. But here's the question. Where does the state get off regulating marriage? I mean, why?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've actually done uncharacteristically a little bit of research on
this. Oh, you've been
working
hard for that non-pay,
marriage,
huh?
Marriage isn't something invented by the state, and it's not something invented by the church. It's a phenomenon that has been found in all human societies that the social scientists know about.
Yeah, so it predates organized religion, predates large, complex political societies.
So the states didn't invent it. They
just
came across it.
How come they get to regulate it,
then? Like mountains and things like that. Well, marriage differs from, say, friendship in that marriage has traditionally involved a whole host of things. Not every society uses marriage for all of them, but a lot of them intersect with things that are clearly state responsibilities.
Give me some examples
here. Well, finances.
Oh, well, that's true.
So marriage is a way of making financial and thus social bonds between the in-laws. That's an important
thing. Well, that's one thing.
That's why a lot of marriages are arranged.
There's the one thing I thought you were going to say you didn't. I thought you were more of a dirty old man. What about, sexual relationships?
Well, sexual relations are important. They give traditionally or often they give the male exclusive rights to the female sexual relationships and vice versa.
Yeah, vice versa. Vice versa is important, right?
And marriage can be polygamy or polyandry. That's not as common.
Yeah.
But also property rights. In other words, lines of inheritance. You get married, and that means you are de facto or at least default the father of these children, and they have a default right to your inheritance. So getting the lines of succession, these are all things, property, sexual relationships that are often precipitate violence.
The legitimacy of children,
ensuring bonds between the various groups. These are all important to the state, and so it didn't come along and say, let's take over marriage. It's not like saying, let's take over friendship and say who can be friends.
I know, but I still don't...
It's a legitimate state concern, Ken. What's your problem?
I just don't know what the extent and limits of this thing is. I mean, it's one thing to say, the state needs to regulate property rights, but anybody in an intimate relation, there might be a question about how to distribute their property. So why should that kind of concern say, these people can't get married. These people of different races can't get married. Why should the state have an interest in saying that out of its concern for property or children or something like that? I don't get it.
There's really two questions. One, can the state say that? Is marriage something the state can say does or doesn't occur? There are all kinds of marriages. The state can build recognition of some of them into its laws, but I don't really know that it makes
sense.
They can't occur.
Yeah, I wonder why the state has this concern for traditional marriage. That's what I'm wondering. Right.
Well, to tell you the truth, traditional marriage has been getting a fair amount of attention lately, in part due to President Bush's recent State of the Union address. Our own roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, files this report.
Our nation must defend the sanctity of marriage.
In his January 2004 State of the Union address, President Bush hinted at a constitutional amendment to prohibit gay marriage.
If judges insist on forcing their arbitrary will upon the people, the only alternative left to the people would be the constitutional process.
the framers designed a constitution that could be amended and has been amended many times, but the constitution is very difficult to change.
That's Sarah Beringer Gordon, professor of law and history at the University of Pennsylvania.
It requires a two-thirds, a supermajority of the states to ratify a constitutional amendment, and we have, I think, wisely been reluctant to make very many amendments. Prohibition taught many people that trying to exercise too much social control through constitutional amendments can be a very big mistake.
Marriage is traditionally a state matter, but this isn't the first time the federal government has gotten involved.
That became very complicated for the first time in the 19th century, when in the territory of Utah, Mormons began to practice and to defend their right to practice a form of marriage they called plural marriage, which we commonly call polygamy. And it was a lively question whether or not the national government could prohibit the Mormons from practicing polygamy. And to make a very long and complex story short, the answer finally was yes. Congress did have the power to prohibit polygamy.
To make the short story a little longer, the court opposed polygamy because it was considered an unequal, unfair relationship with one man holding power over many women. Gordon says it would be hard to oppose gay marriage on the same grounds. But either way, you may be asking, why get the state involved in marriage at all?
The form of marriage and the commitment to marriage has been extremely important to the state, both for guaranteeing the orderly transmission of property from one generation to another, for avoiding bloodshed, determining who is married to whom, all kinds of things that could produce chaos in society. And marriage also, for all its faults, has been the most reliable place to raise the next generation. And of course, the next generation is extremely important to the state.
In other words, those same sentimental, romantic reasons that many of us get married in the first place. For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks, Amy, for that report. We're now going to be joined by our guest philosopher. He is Richard Moore, professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois. Richard joins us from station WILL at the University of Illinois, there in Champaign-Urbana, or Urbana-Champaign, as the case may be. Richard began his career studying Plato and Aristotle. But since the mid-1980s, he has chiefly written about social issues affecting gay and lesbian Americans. He's written books, scholarly articles, pieces for the Chronicle of Higher Education, The Advocate, The Nation, the Chicago Tribune, and the Boston Globe. Richard, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Richard. Before we get to the question, I think the question of gay marriage is going to occupy a fair part of our discussion. But before we get to that, I want to discuss the nature of marriage in general with you and sort of the kinds of reasons that the state might or might not have for saying who can and cannot be married. So what's your view? I mean, help me understand, what is marriage anyway? And where does any state authority to regulate it come from?
Well, my view of what marriage is that it's a mode of living, that marriage is the development of intimacy through the medium of everyday life, the day-to-day. I put this poetically, that marriage is the fused intersection of love, sanctity, and necessity's demand.
That's very nice.
You're married to someone when your love for that person and their love for you is grounded and grows in the very means by which you jointly meet your basic needs by maintaining a household and fulfilling other everyday needs.
Richard, wouldn't that mean that a lot of people who, if you ask them, say they weren't married, they were just living together, are actually married?
Indeed. In fact, I was doing that for 25 years until November, when my partner, now hubby, went to Toronto and got married.
Yeah.
In the eyes of the province of Ontario.
Right. Wouldn't that also mean that a lot of people who are officially married because their relationship is one of convenience or something like that, without deep intimacy of the kind you're talking about, who are officially married, aren't really married?
Right. And we do, and we are concerned with that legally speaking, and that the state is willing to discover whether green card marriages are phony or not. So we do allow the state to intrude to check the criteria for people being married. Sometimes the argument is, well, we let people that are over 60 years old get married, and we let people who are impotent get married, even while we're asserting that marriage is for the sake of children. And then the claim is that, oh, well, it's a private relationship and the state can't get in there. But in fact, we do let the state get in there in these green card cases.
Yeah, but what do you think is the kind of principle on the basis of which the state can legitimately intervene in marriage and say who can and can't get married?
Well, if you take my definition of marriage as sort of a mode of living, then the state is a means of supporting that.
Yeah.
If marriage, as I understand it, is an important value, then the state can support it. My view is the state can pretty much do anything it wants to as long as it doesn't violate somebody's rights. So if marriage is a value worth supporting, the state can support it. And well, basically, it takes the form of supporting when necessity turns cussed. So
what do you mean by that?
It means that the obligation of mutual support, the state wants to have that going, because if one person gets sick or something, the other one comes to their aid.
Yeah.
So the state establishes privacy rights around marriage. Why? Because in marriage, you have to have trust between the people, and yet there's this enormous transparency of information between the people. So this combination of truth and transparency can't be maintained.
So there's this
always,
traditional...
always looking over your shoulder. So that's why we have this immunity right that comes with marriage against the state.
John Perry has a point he wants. Richard, John Perry has a point he wants to make.
Your concept of necessity seems to take care of this traditional role marriage has for helping keep property rights, inheritance rights, and giving people a certain monopoly over the labor of their spouse. Is that all included in your concept of necessity?
The requirement of support is simply up to the level of having the person's needs met, material needs met. It's not a requirement to give them fancy things.
Richard, I'm not quite sure. I want to test your definition a little bit and your argument for the right of the state to intervene at all. I mean, friendship sounds like a version of the same sort of thing. Imagine a deep, lifelong, enduring friendship in which the parties pledge mutual aid and support to one another.
That's none of the state's business.
Well, that seems obviously none of the state's business. So, I mean, why would the state have a business regulating marriage on your definition of it?
Normally, we don't consider friendships marital relations because the friends aren't developing their intimate relationship through the instrumentalities of day-to-day living. They're not developing the uniqueness of their relationship by buying a house. They're not developing the uniqueness of their relationship by having sex together.
Right. So
it's the undertaking.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Friendships are not examples of marriages.
Yeah. And they're not examples of things that the state may regulate, because you're saying it's the kind of undertaking of a kind of commitment and joint life and all that stuff that, through certain kind of instrumentalities, as you put it, that make it possible for the state to have any interest in this thing?
Well, what I'm saying is that we wouldn't give the immunity right against testifying against somebody else to people that are merely friends.
Yeah.
We do give it to marital couples because of this necessity for there to be both trust and transparency in the relationship.
This is a philosophy talk. Is marriage a purely private matter, a natural practice that the state has no business regulating? Or do you think that the state should have the power to say who can and cannot marry?
We want your input. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. You can also visit our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and click on the comments link to send us email. And if you've been to the website before, be sure to go back again now. It's really turned into something quite spectacular.
Yeah, it's really cool. Philosophy Talk continues after this short break.
The Dixie Cups, on their way to the Chapel of Love. and we're getting into the philosophy of marriage. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk.
Today we're talking to Richard Moore about philosophical aspects of marriage, and in particular, does the state have any business saying who and who can't be married and who can't be unmarried, for that matter?
Who should you marry? Should that be up entirely up to you? Should the state have any voice in constraining your choices?
Give us a call at 415-841-4134 or visit our website at www.philosophytalk.org. That's O-R-G. And click on the comments link to send us an email.
So, Richard, so far we've managed to not talk about what's going to be a hot topic in the coming political season, this issue about gay marriage. And I'm going to ask you a question out of left field to get that started a little bit. Okay, I know you're an advocate of gay marriage. I know you are in a gay marriage. But let me ask you the question. Are there any arguments that come from the other side that have given you even a moment's pause? Any arguments that at least keep you thinking, this is a place where I need to shore up my own side of the argument? Any of them at all?
No. What's interesting about the opposition to gay marriage side is that they don't really have any arguments. They just say that what somehow automatically a male and female have to be the components of a marriage. And notice how some of the standard definitions of marriage simply turn out to be circular. So the standard legal definition of marriage is the legal union of one man and one woman as husband and wife. But what are husbands and wives? Well, they're spouses of one gender or the other. What's a spouse? Well, it's somebody who's married to somebody. So here we have a very short circle, very short loop that does no explanatory work at all.
Okay, I'm going to let a caller in here. Chris in Berkeley is on the line. Welcome
Hi.
To Philosophy Talk, Chris.
Hi, I've got a couple of points about marriage in the church, church's relation to it.
Let's hear them.
Well, the first is, theologically, the current thinking, at least in the Episcopal tradition, which is one of the more liberal Protestant denominations, is that marriage is really acknowledging a relationship that already exists more than creating something out of whole cloth.
Okay.
Does that mean that the actual religious event of marriage is recognizing something that already exists?
Right.
Is that thing that already exists a marriage?
Well, that the relationship between the couple is something that already exists.
Okay. Well, what are you going to do with that point? I'm not quite sure where you're going. Help me see where you're going.
Well, so my second point is about the fact that a lot of clergy are really questioning whether it's appropriate for them to be functionaries of the state in this, that religious marriage ought to be perhaps considered separately from the civic function of marriage.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So, Richard, I just
point out that Voltaire, one of our favorite philosophers, made that point very emphatically. He said, look, marriage is something that's there, and then there's the civil laws about it, and then there's the religious sacrament. And he says, if you don't keep those three things separately, you end up in a pretty bad situation.
Richard, you want to weigh in there at all?
It is peculiar that marriage is this two-step thing, that when you get a license from the state, and then the state requires that you have what's called a solemnization ceremony.
That sounds very solemn.
Somebody gives you vows to say, and that can be a religious person, a captain of a ship. All sorts of people can do this. In Canada, it's been made complicated because 10 years ago, they eliminated justices of the peace. And so cities have scrambled to sort of hire people who are actual ministers in some religion to do this for them, although the ceremonies themselves are secular.
In America, you can go to the web and become eligible to marry someone on the religious side of things in about 10 minutes. I did that once at the request of a graduate student and his fiancée.
Richard, some of the opposition to gay marriage comes from people of a religious frame of mind. You know, their religion seems to them to prohibit that. They want to have that view of theirs enshrined in the state in which they live. I mean, they think it's a deep moral or religious thing. What do you think of arguments like that come from those kind of quarters?
Well, it's not just them. It's the President of the United States
who
makes an appeal to the concept of sanctity. And even we should remember, though, just to be fair, that Al Gore was also speaking this language.
Yeah.
So it's not exclusively a Republican situation. My view on that is that I just there should be a separation of church and state here. And if the only arguments that conservatives can make are of a religious sort, then they're simply illegitimate as a grounds for public policy.
Why don't you give us a call and join our discussion at area code 415-841-4134. John, you
Richard,
want to make a point?
I certainly agree with that. First Amendment consideration should keep religion out of it. On the other hand, since marriage is a pre-existing institution, you might say the state really shouldn't be out in front. It should really kind of reflect whatever marriages in the culture or in the populace are like.
That's
and
it.
That gets into a second thing, is that up until this Mormon decision that about polygamy that Amy talked about, the idea that there should be different marital setups for different states didn't seem strange to people at all. So places like California and Vermont, where there's apparently enough gay marriages that that seems to be what marriage is, it should be recognized. But why should it be recognized in South Dakota or Mississippi, where that isn't what marriage
is? Yeah, you started to say something about what are legitimate reasons for public policy or not. Can you expand on that? I mean, if I'm a religiously oriented person and I'm motivated by my religious belief to try to make public policy be a certain way, what's to prevent that?
Well, usually there are reasons for public policy besides religious reasons. But if the only reason that can be advanced is a religious one, then it becomes an illegitimate
motivation for
public policy.
It's not a question of the religion per se. It's the question of what motivates me as a citizen of the society.
Since many people have motivations that are illegitimate in public policy, that's why we have the courts to doubt people's motives.
Your religion might say that Jews and Gentiles shouldn't be friends, but having that view shouldn't support the state inflicting it on others.
I'm going to let a caller in here, Philip in Brisbane. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philip. You there, Philip?
Yes, hello. Well, I'm just wondering if we could get a rational discussion about the issue of marriage from the state, considering that when our president, the chief of state, was asked who his most influential philosopher or his favorite philosopher was, he answered Jesus, who's a religious figure. And my understanding is that philosophy is the search for truth, whereas religion is a statement that you are adhering to an absolute truth which is already established.
Well, I think that's a pretty good question. Now, we can say on Bush's behalf that he feels the issue should be a matter of principle. He says marriage is a sacred institution between a man and a woman. Today's decision, speaking about the Massachusetts decision that said that gay marriages should be legitimated by the legislature, violates this important principle. So there must be a principle there, although what it is may be a little hard to say.
Richard, can you help us with that, Richard?
Yeah, and notice he doesn't say what the content of the relationship is between the man and the woman that's supposed to make it uniquely marital and unique to men and women. Whereas my definition, can be two men, two women, man and woman, whatever the development.
Well, how about the issue of polygamy or whatever it would be properly called? How about one man and several men, one man, several women, one woman, several man? Does your definition rule that out?
My definition does not rule that out. What rules that out is that people are like cats, and if you've had two cats and you've had three cats, there's a huge difference.
Yeah. We're talking to Richard Moore. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We have a caller on the line, Rob in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Rob. You there, Rob? I think we've lost Rob. Next must be Cozy in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Cozy.
Oh, hello. I'm just running for the radio here. You caught me by surprise. I have a couple of quick comments. One is about this idea, I think I'm hearing correctly, that intimacy, which is a very recent Californian idea.
Well, I don't know about that. You mean people in New York aren't intimate with one another?
Yes. No, but I'm saying its presentation, why is it a public virtue rather than a private desire? I mean, there are many forms of intimacy.
Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to say is that I think we have to look at the history of marriage, by which it is an arrangement that men own women and their property and their children.
Yeah. There is that.
Came out of the 60s where we challenged these things, and there has to be a better way of doing it.
No, thank you, Cozy. That's very interesting. I mean, there is certainly the Marxist line on family is that it's an instrument of capitalist oppression. And certainly, if you look at the history of marriage, it's certainly women in marital situations throughout the ages have been considered property of one sort or another. And certainly, you can think of it as a form of oppression. But I want to go to Cozy's point, Richard, about why should the state care about promoting this or that form of intimacy?
Well, what I can say is that while no one was looking, American law has eliminated gender distinctions within marriage.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, it used to be the case that, in the words of Blackstone, that the marital relation was equivalent to one person, and it was the husband. And the husband could sell the woman's property, and the woman couldn't make contracts independently of her husband and the like. But all of that from the 60s into the 80s were eliminated either legislatively or by the Supreme Court.
That sounds like great progress.
There are no gender distinctions within legal marriage in America now. So there's no reason in the eyes of the law why the two members of the marriage have to be on the one hand a man and the other hand a woman. This transition happened and nobody noticed it.
Richard, I think that's an extremely persuasive point. I want to go back to an earlier point you made that didn't seem to me so persuasive. Your reasons against polygamy seemed a little weak. It basically was the empirical point that three cats don't get along as well as two cats. But isn't that very sure for one thing and not very relevant for another if there are, in fact, lots of people out there that find threesomes and foursomes how they want to be intimate and live their lives and support each other?
I'm not saying that polygamists shouldn't be allowed to get married. I'm saying it will be an option that few people take.
Yeah.
What I find interesting about polygamy is what is America's obsession with it? And my guess is that probably people think that they're going to be simply a function rather than unique in a relationship that has more than two people, somehow the intimacy and the uniqueness of it will be lost. And I suspect that there'll be this loss of identity somehow if we allow polygamous relationships.
I think that's a very interesting point. I mean, certainly if you look at the practice of polygamy where in the past, it has been not a sphere of equality. Right, and it seems to me one interest that the state can have, and this goes to your point about the erasing of gender distinctions, is making marriage a sphere of equality rather than a sphere of inequality. John, you want to make a point?
Well, I do want to make a point. I think claims about if we look at marriage, we'll find this are pretty dubious because I don't think any of the three of us or very many social scientists would claim to know all that much. I think a lot of...
I claim to know everything. I don't know about you.
The reason for the obsession in America with polygamy is that we had a major religion founded in America that for a long time was polygamous, and then we had a huge court battle about whether they had to give that up to become a state. If you look at that court records, the arguments against it are pretty weak.
Yeah. When did we let it call?
Whatever the facts about Mormon marriages are, the concept is certainly not one that fits the stereotype you just enunciated.
I don't think that... I'm not saying the concept it makes it a sphere of inequality, but the practice, historical practice, makes it the sphere of inequality. But I want to take a caller. Benjamin in Montero is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Benjamin.
Yeah, hi. You know, I got married a few years ago and did a bit of research, and being also...
You mean before you got married?
Yeah.
A very careful kind of guy.
Yeah.
Well, being a philosophy post-grad, and anyway, you know, and I found that it was the most boring thing. You know, I got the best results from Hegel. And if you took away all the sort of...
you didn't marry Hegel. You researched marriage. Really.
So it's the philosophy of marriage that's boring, not your marriage, right? Okay.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, he was taken.
Go ahead, Benjamin.
If you can sort of, you know, divorce Hegel from the heavy baggage that we put on him, but his thought on that the ceremony is for the children and for... to give the children a sort of a structure to grow on, and a structure that gives them now and for the future something to rely on. There is some sort of a body greater than themselves. I thought that was really compelling, and much more so than any of the other ideas that were lying around for me.
Thanks, Benjamin. But, you know, that's
could
true.
Could I chime in on just a little tiny one sure. on the polygamy issue? When I lived in Africa, some of the families that I was with, the polygamists, the women would actually go on strike if one of them was mistreated by the men.
Yeah.
So I found that, you know, to the point that it worked, they really were really strong among themselves.
Yeah. Thanks, Benjamin. I think there's a. I want to go back to the point about children and marriage and all that. I mean, surely the state has an interest in sort of regulating how the next generation is reared so that they're full, autonomous, functioning people. And if the state says, well, the marriage institution and sanctioning that is a good means to that, that seems like a legitimate rationale.
But we couldn't very well claim that in America today that is the sole or unique purpose of marriage.
Or that it does it very well, even.
There's all kinds of marriages where there is no intention to have children. There are no children, in fact. Late marriages where everybody's got more children than they would want to increase and so forth.
Yeah. Right. You want to weigh in on this, Richard?
So when people object to gays getting married on the children issue, it's just a red herring.
I mean, it
really is a red herring, since we allow people who are impotent and infertile and over 60 years old to get married to suddenly say, oh, well, gays can't have children,
I understand.
So they can't get married.
I agree with you, but I want to say they could say, somebody could say, who wasn't just interested in red herrings, well, what marriage aims at, you know, in the paradigm case, is an institution that will promote the well-being and autonomy and flourishing of the next generation. I mean, somebody could make an argument like that.
Well, then we'd be sure to be exploring the impotent and the infertile and not let them get married if that was our deep concern.
Okay.
Of course.
Chris from Oakland
so
is
in
on
fact,
the line. Sorry. Chris from Oakland is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Chris.
Hi. My question, or the thought that I'd like to pose and have a response to, follows somewhat in the steps of Voltaire, in that I'm wondering whether this may be an issue of semantics, whether, given that we've put out this term marriage as part of the equation, which has loads and loads of religious connotations heaped upon it, whether if we were pursuing strictly a civil union policy and looking for equal protection in equal rights in terms of things that the state does regulate, whether that would take some of the sort of spiritual sting out of it for those of the religious, sort of conservative religious persuasion, and whether if we were pursuing civil unions that were strictly a matter of law, whether there may be more sympathy and more success with that path.
Thanks, Chris. That's a good question.
We're coming up on a break. So
I noticed that Governor Dean takes pride that they've got civil unions in Vermont but not marriages. What does that look like from the perspective of advocates of gay marriage, Richard?
It looks like old-fashioned separate but equal, which ain't equal.
So is it just the word that's at stake, though?
There are important symbols, and equality primarily has to do with symbols. It's saying you're separate, you're different, and that's the one main way that America puts it.
But it's a little bit different from separate but equal, meaning different, separate classrooms. I mean, this is separate words. It's a little more attenuated. I'm not saying it's not important.
It's to the extent that marriage is loaded up with all of this symbolism and gay people are excluded from this symbolism, that's to put gay people down.
Point taken. Up next, the 60-second philosopher. Ian Scholes walks us through philosophical views of marriage through the ages.
There's more of Philosophy Talk after this short break.
All the days of my life.
Linda Ronstadt with Dolly Parton and their great piece, I Will Never Marry. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This week's program is tackling the question of marriage. What business does the state have being in the business of marriage anyway? We'll take some more calls at 415-841-4134. But first, let's turn things over to Ian Scholes, philosophizing about marriage. Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher. Today, Ian reprises some of the greatest hits of nearly 2,500 years of philosophical thought about marriage. We give him a little extra time this week to fit it all in. Ready? Go!
Ian Scholes. Marriage was once judged by the number of offspring it produced. This meant that a woman had to be present, a being largely viewed by men purely as a child-bearing object. Plato did think that women should be given the same education as a man, though his pupil, the compulsive listmaker Aristotle, disagreed. Aristotle also thought wives should avoid gossip, not spend money in fancy clothes, obey husbands in all things, and pay no attention to politics. Then came Christianity. Thomas Aquinas thought matrimony had several goods. Marriage produced children, who can be educated to worship God, and it is a sacrament. The indivisibility of matrimony mirrors the union of Christ and Church. St. Augustine believed that marriage was good, but couples should have sex only for procreation and not enjoy it. Then came the Enlightenment. Immanuel Kant believed that marriage is completed by conjugal cohabitation. If that does not happen, either party should be able to dissolve the marriage. Hegel believed that when a woman marries, she is liberated from indeterminate subjectivity, that is, too many empty choices, and achieves through family duty true freedom. I am soccer mom, therefore I am, you might say. Jean-Jacques Rousseau gave us the concept of the noble savage, best illustrated by Tarzan movies. He thought the state should raise children and women should take care of men. His common-law wife took care of him, and he dumped his 5 kids in an orphanage. So there you go. Nietzsche wrote, quote, "Man is for woman a means. The end is always the child. Two things are wanted by the true man, danger and play. Thou goest to women, don't forget thy whip," unquote. This tough guy never married. John Stuart Mill, in 1869, wrote, quote, "It is necessary to society that women should marry and produce children. They will not do so unless they are compelled. Therefore, it is necessary to compel them," unquote. He was being ironic, of course. His On This Objection of Women posited that perfect equality was needed between the sexes. John Locke seemed to believe that if a husband and wife want to split up after the kids are grown, well, why not? The job's been accomplished, after all. Gloomy Schopenhauer thought that women lacked a sense of justice, honor, and reason, and a man should seek by all means to escape their insidious influence. He succeeded. At least he never married. Marx and Engels declared, quote, "The bourgeois sees in his wife nothing but an instrument of production," unquote. But then Marx never had a job himself. He lived off an inheritance and money from Engels. He did, however, have a maid. Bertrand Russell wrote a book, Marriage and Morals, controversial in 1932, advocating openness about sex and sex education. He was married 4 times, his last when he was over 80. We will give Kierkegaard the last word, quote, "When two beings fall in love with one another and begin to suspect they were made for each other, it is time to have the courage to break it off, for by going on they have everything to lose and nothing to gain," unquote. He himself fell in love, broke it off, and anguished about it the rest of his life. Philosophers, you gotta love them, but it's not always easy. I gotta go.
A Mile a Minute, 60-Second Philosopher, Ian Scholes. I'm John Perry, and no matter what Ian says, some of my best friends are philosophers.
Although I know secondhand how tough it is to be married to one of them. I'm Ken Taylor.
Which one of them is it tough to be married to?
This is Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Richard Moore, philosophy professor from University of Illinois. We have a caller in the line, Megan in Richmond. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Megan.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome. What's your question or comment?
Comment is, I think I'm on the knife edge of between conservative and liberal in that I think the state does have a place in marriage. It's a very limited one. It's a form of a contract, I suppose, that the state in some way enforces. But the knife edge that I'm on is I'm not in favor of polygamy because it doesn't make any sense. I don't see if you allow for a multiple marriage how that can be exclusive. But going back to the point I really want to address, that is gay marriage, I don't see how the state can enforce that except in some way that would be so invasive it would make the Privacy Act look like the 14th Amendment.
Right.
Is that the one that freed the slaves? Anyway, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah,
it's one of them.
Because they'd either have to take your DNA or look up your dress. No thanks.
Yeah. So, Richard, what do you think of that point? The state that would prohibit gay marriage would be an extremely oppressive state because of the powers it would have to have.
Well, I certainly think that the state should allow gays to marry. One of the main forms of oppression of gays now is that they're not allowed access to this institution by which most people define central parts of their lives.
Yeah. So, you know, I have a question that we haven't talked about at all. I mean, that we've been assuming that the state, you know, when people get married, the state floods them with benefits. What about the single folks? Who speaks up for the single folks? Why should the state favor marriage over non-marriage at all? I mean, why should it flood all these benefits on
married
people?
Just to follow up on that, historically, one reason is that we all thought that we wanted the population to grow. That is, most states thought that was in their interest. But now, at least as global citizens, we probably want it to decrease or at least level off.
Yeah.
So
Richard,
why not have advantages for people that don't have kids?
Yeah, Richard, tell me. Why should the state favor marriage over
marriage? Marriage also comes with obligations, especially the obligation of mutual support, so it's not a free ride by any means. I certainly think that the goods flowing to marriage should not be so extensive as to create oppressive conditions for people that are single, but I don't see that happening now.
Yeah. Julian in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Julian.
Hello. My question is a slightly different topic. In all societies, marriage is seen as an event that involves not only the participants, but members of the participants' families and friends and communities. Also, in all societies, marriage is seen as an event which has certain rituals and customs. To what extent should the participants of a marriage, when planning their marriage, consider the feelings and desires of their families and communities in deciding on the particular ritual that they will choose?
Well, that's an interesting question, but I think that depends on whether the family's a bunch of jerks or the rituals are oppressive and outmoded. I think there's no blanket answer to that myself. I don't know. What are you doing with it?
Parents are wonderful people.
I think if the parents are wonderful people and the ritual isn't so onerous that you just can't live with yourself for going through with it, you ought to go through with it. But I'm always a pleaser and a compromiser, so maybe that's not a very deep answer.
Rich, do you have a view about that?
Many people, including the state, think that the marriage ceremony, the wedding, is what creates the marital relationship. And I think that that's wrong. I agreed with the earlier caller that these marriages are a lived experience, and then somehow they become religiously and legally acknowledged. Mm-hmm. My view of weddings is that they should be viewed as bon voyage parties.
Bon voyage? To a single life?
Wishing the partners well on this journey that they're going to make together, rather than being viewed as what creates the relationship as a marital relation.
Let me just review a couple of concepts, and you guys can tell me if I've got it right.
Probably not.
Yeah, probably. It sounds like there is a phenomenon, a relationship that's called marriage, and it's called marriage, whether it's legal or illegal, recognized or not, within or without a church. So we talk about common law marriages and so forth and so on. Then, because that relationship typically is involved in the sorts of things that amount to at least an implicit contract, the state has an interest in setting up a structure that more or less enforces the contract and explains what's involved in it, just as it has a structure for all sorts of other contracts. And then finally, the state can refuse to implement that with respect to certain kinds of marriages, such as gay marriages. And that's one thing we haven't found any very good reason for today, although, you know, we've tried to give both sides their chance. I must admit, I don't see it. And finally, there's the word. And that's the difference, I think, between Vermont and Massachusetts at this point. That is the word marriage. And Richard makes the important point that even if it's just a word, even if you have exactly the same state weight enforcing the contract with both the civil unions and the marriage, words are symbols, and symbols are important, and it smells a little bit like separate but not equal. Is that a fair review?
Richard?
That's my take. I actually disagree that marriage should be fundamentally viewed as a contract. I think this is not helpful and perhaps even conceptually confusing. Notice with a contract, you get to set the terms, but with marriage, you're buying into a package. So it really isn't. Marriages really don't have the structure of a contract.
Right, but it's a set of mutual reciprocal obligations and commitments. Right?
It's sort of an implicit contract involved in the whole thing, isn't it? Because you can make these prenups that more or less change the defaults from what they might otherwise be.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, I'm not sure that there is, I don't know what you two folks think. I'm not sure that there's a kind of essence to marriage. I mean, marriage has been so many different things in so many cultural settings that there is something called marriage everywhere or often, and the society, the culture, the religion, the state comes along and configures it in a certain way, and it's configured it in all kinds of ways, it seems to me.
If you understand marriage as I do, as the intersection of intimacy and a day-to-day life, it's not surprising that it's existed in all cultures that we know of, because we're the sort of creatures that have intimate relationships, and we're the sort of creatures that have needs, and it's not surprising that people put these two together. So that explains why it's such a universal phenomenon, if you understand it according to my definition.
I think that's a nice understanding, Richard. But I mean, That would seem to suggest somebody said intimacy was a California idea. That seems wrong, but it is a kind of that men and women should have this sphere of intimacy, deep intimacy, and especially that it should be a sphere of equality is a pretty modern idea. And if you go back over the long history of human life, I don't think marriage has been a sphere of equal intimacy and reciprocal commitments of that sort. So, I mean, would you say those were non-marriages? Or aren't you just playing a kind of culturally specific of-the-moment conception of things?
By an intimate relationship, I mean a relationship that has the texture it has because of the uniqueness of the individuals that are in it, as opposed to a functional relationship where people are operating as types or kinds in relationship to each other.
So what could say, Ken,
I mean, what's wrong with using a modern concept of marriage since we are living in now?
Well, that's
not
true.
Not some ancient time.
We'll give Richard the last word on this. Thank you very much for joining us, Richard. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you. Hopefully we've changed some minds.
Yeah. So have you learned anything deep and new, John?
Well, I think so. I think the point Richard makes about separate but equal applying to symbols is important. As a political matter, I wonder if in the long run it would matter that much if the gay community just said, let's go for civil unions, and the words will fill in the gap later. But who am I to say?
Well, you're the co-host of Philosophy Talk.
That's something.
Okay.
Love and marriage, they go together like a horse and carriage. This I'll tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. No, sir.
Stuck in a quandary? Why not give us a call? We won't solve your problems, but we'll make them a whole lot more complicated than you ever thought they could be. A little something we call a conundrum.
We have a listener named Chris. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Where are you calling from, Chris?
I'm calling from Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
That's one of those little states back east, right? It's kind of stuck in there between Connecticut and Maine somewhere?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Anyway, so what's your conundrum, Chris?
I have a terrible memory.
Oh, goodness.
And
so you don't remember your conundrum? Is that the
problem? terrible memory. I like to read, but within months, it's 90% gone. Does it make sense to keep reading, or should I just relax and watch TV?
Is your memory bad about everything, or just
it's bad
about
everything?
Oh, I see.
Oh,
but books are the kind of thing where I feel like part of the pleasure is being able to say, "Oh yeah, Raskolnikov's friend was named such and such."
Right. Boy, I sympathize with you.
I'm trying to figure out what the philosophical question here is, John. Do you have a take on the philosophical question here?
I think the question you have to ask is, why are you reading? And it sounds like you're feeling bad because you have a certain vision of what reading should do for you. It should it should dump stuff into your memory banks that you'll be useful to you on later occasions. But really, that's not what novels are all about, right?
Yeah.
They're to enjoy.
Yeah,
so,
the reading of it, the experience of reading is the thing you should strive for.
So I would say, you know, it's kind of too bad that your memory keeps you from having these secondary benefits of reading, but keep in mind you're getting the primary benefit.
Yeah, look, let me say, let's make a philosophical distinction, sort of. You're approaching it reading in too utilitarian a way.
Uh-huh.
You're asking, what do I get out of reading? What are the consequences of my having read the novel? And you're weighing whether to read the novel by the sort of downside consequences. But you should think of it more as purely intrinsically aesthetic terms.
So I should feel like it's enough to read the novel and enjoy it as I read it.
Yeah.
You might do like I do and just mostly read trash because you don't feel bad about not remembering.
It's junk food. It goes away. It's like simple carbohydrates. You eat it. It goes away.
Right.
Reading is kind of almost a religious thing in our culture. For example, if you're blind and you listen to a book on tape, that's fine. But if you aren't blind and you listen to a book on tape, people look at you like, what's wrong with him?
Yeah. Right.
Is reading just a way of getting information into the old pipeline? Then recordings ought to be just as good.
Right.
But we don't really think of that way. We think of reading as a positive pleasure. And if you have that, you've got the main thing.
Actually, I want to put in a word for books on tape. Having something read aloud, is a beautiful thing. Anyway, I hope we've helped you with your conundrum.
Yeah, well, I can't remember what you said, but I think I liked it.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for calling Philosophy
Talk. Thank you very much.
And we'd like to invite you to share a conundrum with us.
Some sort of riddle or puzzle that has shown up in your world?
If you are bedeviled by a philosophical riddle, send an email describing your conundrum to conundrums@philosophytalk.org, and you can also just do it from our webpage.
But sure to tell us where we can reach it, just in case we pick you for the program. Once again, that's conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
So, Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2004.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle, the Pearl.
Our production team includes Peter Crimmins, Amy Standen, Monica Blakely, Alex Martinez, Jim Swenson, Merle Kessler, Matt Bauer, Alan Acosta, and Olga Kramer of Whitetail Designs.
And special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institute, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
That's not all. From the Provost Office at Stanford University, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, Stanford's Office of Public Affairs, the Stanford Humanities Center, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates. They make our shoestring possible.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
Or anybody else, for that matter. For more information, visit our website, www.philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you so much for listening.
And thank you for thinking.